Well, hi, everybody, and welcome to the Early Birds. I wanted to especially thank you for your responses to the questions about what you'd most like to focus on and get out of our seminar series. I want to spend just a few minutes at the beginning of this seminar, and I'm keeping an open mic, so I'll ask you to manage the background noise, to address a couple of questions that have arisen in different forms but are essentially the same questions about how can you facilitate change in the best way with clients and help them address things that will create a permanent change. First, for one aspect of that, I think that helping people remain confident in their abilities and strength, anytime you do something that's new and different, it's going to register as discomfort. That's simply the way our mind and brains work. We do something different, it breaks the script. The error detection mechanism in our brain says, this isn't what I expected, so there's a bit of discomfort. Now, this is what we will, I believe, continuously help our clients to understand, that this is a reading of change, not of your gut telling you it's the wrong thing to do or your instinct saying it's not right. This is simply our reaction to change. So this is when we can help someone frame it as the recognition of doing something new and different that first registers as a kind of discomfort. So that framework looks at possibility. Now, here's another way to think about it. We touched on this a bit last time. Our brains don't know the difference between anxiety and excitement. So how you frame that determines how you proceed. If you frame it as anxiety, it means better head for cover. It makes sense to stop. If you frame it as challenge, as excitement, as possibility, then you look for a new framework to proceed. This is exactly what we do as coaches. So alongside that, a limiting assumption can be, well, I need to be comfortable before I really proceed, or I need to be confident before I do this, or I need to have everything in place before I launch my website. The assumption makes it make sense to stop, which immediately alleviates any kind of trepidation or anxiety. So how we're listening to a client, and this is a repetition, but I want to be sure that we're clear about this, because I see, and I really appreciate you guys sending in the questions and things that you'd like to address. We're listening not just for the content of what somebody says, but we're listening at another level for the process. This is how every aspect of someone's operating system, and remember, 90 to 95% of the operating system is unconscious, so someone may not be aware of it. So we're listening at this level, have created an alliance to collaborate and understand that. So here's the premise. Every algorithm that determines feeling, thinking, behaving, anything that someone does will manifest in the relationship with you. So this is where we create a working alliance, a collaborative alliance, to be able to look at that and to see what facilitates and what interferes. So these are aspects of how we frame something with a client, the framing of possibility, of excitement, the framing, instead of a problem, a possibility. If someone pursues a problem, they go down a pathway that's already been well-honed and well-established, and this is why some people get stuck in therapy, because they go down that pathway and it etches it further every time you look at a problem, even ostensibly to resolve it. So this is where our work with a client is in the choice architecture of this moment, of now and next. And with every client I work with in mentor coaching, I request at the beginning, may I interrupt you at some point if I think it would be helpful for us to consider looking at something at this moment? And I give them, and nobody except my wife has ever declined that, but she does regularly. And I give them permission to interrupt me, because if something doesn't quite make sense and is a little convoluted, which I'm known for, then we might as well do it right there. So when a client begins, well, the problem is, boom, I want to interrupt that client because they're going down a pathway that's already known. This is how we tend to repeat. We tend to go back over the problems. Think about, you have a glass of Chardonnay on the patio with some buddies. How long does it take to get into an animated conversation about something really challenging that happened or the problem somebody had? This is what we do differently in coaching, to look at framing this new story. What would you like us to focus on? Where would you like us to get to? The two coordinates of that map. And then to develop that story and then to put it in a summary and a commitment at the end. That's a coaching model. There are many coaching models. That one works really well because it has the same components of every story, a challenge, a development, and a resolution. And our minds, our brains, are hardwired to want and understand and develop stories. So I hope this addresses some of the things that many of you have mentioned about what you'd most like to get to this seminar series. Any additions or comments from anyone before we go on lecture mode? Here's another kind of answer. I'm continuing with open mic for just a second. The basic question distilled from a number of your comments, how do you get somebody to change? This is our specialty, by the way, of how we can facilitate, be a catalyst for change. Well, Blaise Pascal, French mathematician and philosopher in the 1600s, knew the answer. He said, people are generally better persuaded by the reasons which they themselves have discovered than by those which have come into the minds from others. So basically, this is what we know. We commit to what we co-create, and this is why we want our client to synthesize this, make a commitment, and say it out loud so that it's better remembered and is part of what they are consciously focused on. So Pascal's answer was simple. Don't tell them to change. Evoke the reasons for change that are already in their mind and brain and support those. This is what motivated people to make a shift without resistance. So how we do that is fairly simple. We ask open-ended questions. We do an empathic resonance with someone. We do reflective listening. And we even summarize with open-ended questions. And that's the antithesis of facts, information, directives, and suggestions. So I hope this, and another way of saying that, and here's the preface to what we're going to be talking about in this seminar, Mastery of States of Mind and Mentalization. How do we deal with an emotionally charged situation without reacting to it and without letting that situation derail us or boot up a mindset that's less productive? Well, I have an answer. Let's call it the Texas three-step. First, whenever there's anything that's said, pause. Pause for just a second or two to get grounded and centered, especially in emotionally charged situations. Just a second or two to get grounded and centered. Then to resonate with the other person who may have triggered that. And it may simply be, I hear your point of view. And that's all that you can do without engaging someone and understanding, but responding to them. So they feel effective in being heard. That's the essence, the most basic motivation we have as human beings, to be effective. Because if they say something and you're upset and you counter with that, they will not feel heard, so the volume goes up. Maybe they'll hear it if it's a little bit louder. So pretty soon, you're away from that derailment really fast. The third is to respond. You know, I hear your point of view. Here's mine. Or here's a way I'd like us to think about. So the Texas three-step is to pause, to resonate, and respond. And I'll talk about some instances and different aspects of a model that is way more complicated than that in the discussion. So I'm going to go on lecture mode, so you don't have to worry about the background. I recognize that a few of you registered later than our first seminar, and I hope you found the recording to be useful, and the outline and the work tools to download and print. And the recording will be up within 24 hours, probably by the next morning. So any other comments or questions before we go into what we're supposed to be talking about? Okay, I'm going to go on lecture mode then, so you don't have to... Okay, I want to discuss what I think is the most important variable to determine success for people. The mastery of regulating states of mind. Now, a state of mind is a mind-body state, like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information, including how we respond. So each state of mind is a set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns, and a key element in our mentor coaching is to help a client become aware of this process and the various states of mind so that we can discuss what state of mind works best for what purpose. And I'll share a couple of case illustrations of that. Here's a simple example about how states of mind are like different software packages. If you take a rat, put it in a maze, teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, if you put the rat in the maze and you inject that rat with a little bit of amphetamine as you put it in the maze and teach it to get to the cheese, it can go again and again. Now, for that second rat, if you take away the amphetamine, that rat in that maze cannot find the cheese. It can literally die of starvation, even though in a part of its brain, it knows how to get to the cheese. Re-inject the amphetamine, the rat immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. Now, a more common example is how you can think of somebody's, you can't quite think of somebody's name, it's on the tip of your tongue, and then later in a different state of mind, or it just comes to you. So a state of mind is like a mind-body state with a specific software program for each state of mind that determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. We all have a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. A common example is when you're riding, you feel like you have rider's block or you're stuck. That's just not being able to enter the state of mind to be creative. So here's an example. There's a resource I want to mention to you. I think this is a case illustration on it. At the very bottom of my website, Mentor Path, there's a link, there's a click for Master States of Mind. It's about a 15 or 20-minute webinar on mastering states of mind. And I think it's something that might be interesting if you have a bit of time and want to do that. So here's a case illustration. I was working with a woman, I'll call her Barbara, an executive who was having a great experience with coaching. And one of our mentor coaching sessions, she departed, instead of focusing on executive leadership, she said, "You know, Dave, I really want to do something really different." It was right before Thanksgiving when we did it. She said, "I'd like to work on something that I've never been able to sort out about what happens with my family." She's aware of a pattern every time she goes home to her family, and it's usually one major holiday a year. This particular year it was Thanksgiving. She notices the same problem and the same pattern. And she said, "We have a big family gathering where my parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different. This time I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother or sister." And this was a woman in her early 50s, and she was still experiencing this and had not been able to really address it in an effective way. She said, "I can usually last most of the first day, and then something happens, and I just lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family, and that seems to escalate, and then I'm in a fight with all of them, and we're all a standoff for the rest of the holiday time. This doesn't happen except when I'm there with them." And she was a very, very high-functioning executive and didn't need to convince me that this was very specific. Well, I first reflected on how frustrating this was for her to want an enjoyable holiday with her family and have things work out otherwise, and she totally agreed with that. I said, "At the time you're in the middle of that upset, and you're in a full-fledged argument with them, what's the age of that conversation?" And she did not need any. She immediately said, "Early adolescence. I'm 13 or 14 instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit." Well, she wanted to have a meaningful relationship, but in that state, triggered by emotion, she only wanted to be right, to be heard, to express her anger, to express her frustration at not being heard for decades. I asked her specifically what she was aware of that triggered a reaction. And she thought about it for a moment. She described a particular look from her dad. I said, "What else?" "Well, there was a word from her mother, a gesture from her brother that would instantly create that state change to her reactive mode and that time capsule of early adolescence. When her dad rolled his eyes, she was instantly transported back. That anger, resentment that had not changed because it's a time capsule, feeling controlled and criticized by him, not being good enough, expecting negative judgment. I suggested that before she left, this was the last session before she. I suggested that she schedule a time for herself to do a brainstorming session, at least 20 or 30 minutes, where there's no interruptions and no distraction, so so she could reflect on a different plan. I suggested that she put in a column, to have a page where she put three vertical lines so that there are four columns. For the first column, list the specific emotional trigger that she was aware of with each member of her family. And I emphasized that she stay grounded and centered, that she do this only as an observer, that she not get triggered just by writing it down or thinking about it. And then for each emotional trigger, in the second column, to put her usual response, whatever thought or feeling or behavior or negative self-talk that was an automatic reaction to the emotional trigger. This was her age 13 time capsule. I suggested then that she give it at least a day in between and schedule another appointment with herself and do the third and fourth column. I suggested for the third column that she create a mantra to get grounded and centered. A mantra is a cue to initiate the process. She used the cue of touching her ring. A focus phrase that would align the energy field of her brain. And she decided, this was reported later, she didn't decide at the time, relaxed and powerful. And then the physiology, such as a deep breath in for relaxation and breathing out any tension. So that cue and focus and physiology, the mantra, could be used for every one of the emotional triggers. And I suggested that she practice it so that she could more and more and more quickly get grounded in center. The fourth column, for each emotional trigger to put an ideal behavior. What she would ideally like to do so that she didn't have to figure it out at the time. She could get grounded and centered and go to that behavior. So she sent me the initial draft of her four columns before she went home for Thanksgiving, and I was able by email to emphasize the purpose of the first two columns was to cue her radar to recognize not only the emotional triggers, but the resultant state and content for each as quickly as possible in order to get grounded and centered, and then have her ideal response. And I emphasized that this was not the NBA. She had an unlimited number of timeouts. And this was totally new behavior. So whenever she got triggered to do this, and if she needed to pause or get up from the dining table or go to the bathroom or take a walk, to create a way to foster that grounding and centering. In our first session after the Thanksgiving holiday, I was really eager to hear how it went. She immediately began the session by saying it was the best holiday she'd ever had with her family. There were times of challenge, even times when she would have to excuse herself, even to go on a walk or just go to the next room to get grounded and centered. She was immensely pleased with her work, as I was for her. Barbara came to realize that previous emotional triggers, something as simple as her mom saying, "Really now," and the particular eye roll from her dad, could be reframed as the recognition of their humanness, of their and her adulthood. This new attachment pattern allowed her to relate to them in a more continuous adult way. After significant repetition, she rewired her brain, a new default pattern, to create a different response to each cue rather than automatically having that emotional trigger, that cue, result in a state change. And she said in that session after her Thanksgiving, "That was incredible, but it was really hard work." And my response, "You know, I understand how hard and how successfully you worked. The only thing harder, as you already know, was not doing it." So that's just one way to think about regulation of state of mind. And there have been a couple of studies, Scientific American Mind and Harvard Business Review, that find that the ability to self-regulate and self-reflect is the most important finding for success of a large number of executives that they studied. Far more important for their success than degrees or experience or recommendations or a number of other things. Their ability to regulate and self-reflect. And this had direct impact on their different functions. So what we're talking about then is regulation of feelings and states of mind that involve mastery of access while staying present. Let me give you a couple of examples just as a kind of a sidebar here about what other people have done with this. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. I've never done that kind of preparation for any kind of writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction authors, Diane Ackerman, wrote on a pine plank while soaking in a bubble bath to make a freer thought process. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could recreate the experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create and sustain that emotional framework for their evolving story. So the most important thing is that you find your own way to get grounded and centered, and perhaps think about how to do that immediately before you began your engagement with each client each time, and how you sustain that, and even think about the Texas three-step if you get triggered in some way to get grounded, centered, and focused. So this is, I think, important as we are not only regulating our state of mind, but facilitating that with clients. And we're co-creating a model that the client is using and will download as part of their operating model. So we're showing the client what it's like and how it can be to have this appreciation and understanding as they proceed. So the most important thing we can do to achieve success, in my view, is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. So here's a kind of an illustration. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the critical success strategy of regulating and managing states of mind using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind can lead to significant compromise. So the state of mind determines the meaning we attach. The meaning determines the behavior. So this is what becomes important. And back to, and this is the neuroconditioning chart. It's in your outline, those four columns. There are two basic ways to regulate a state of mind. The mantra is the cue, the focus, the physiology. The focus determines exactly what you attend to, and the physiology is to regulate for that full attention. So these are things that I believe can be helpful, that we are showing and engaging in a way with our clients to help them understand and experience with us, not just in theory or just in fact, how they can do this in a particular way. Now, here's a kind of an in vivo example to apply this in a different perspective. I spend part of March every year skiing in Steamboat. I was in the singles line at Steamboat Springs about to advance to the chairlift. An instructor behind me had five kids, all about age six, and asked me if I would mind if two of them rode in the chairlift with me. Of course, I welcomed the opportunity. So as we got on the lift, there were two little girls with me. The little girl next to me had a kind of an awkward seating and seemed to slump a little bit as we were riding and talking. As we progressed with the lift, about midway, she finally said, I was trying to talk with her and I wasn't getting very far, and she finally said, "I'm scared to get off." "I understand," I said. "Do you know who Laurie Hernandez is?" It was just after the Summer Olympics that previous summer when Laurie had won a gold medal in the team event, a silver on the balance team. The little girl and every girl in the world knew it. The little girl next to me said, "Yes." I asked her if she would like to know what Laurie did when she was scared about performing her gymnastics routine and wanted to be totally calm. She immediately said, "Yeah." I told her that Laurie did three things. She pictured herself doing a perfect routine, a vision of exactly how she would perform. Then, the instant before she began, she took a deep breath to breathe in relaxation, breathe out any tension, and said to herself, "I got this." So my new little buddy seemed interested, just a little bit more upright, and then closed her eyes. And she was, I thought, processing this. So we were actually a few seconds from getting off the lift. I asked her if she would say something to herself when she got off. And she said, kind of in a timid, hesitant voice, "I got this." And I nudged her. I said, "Say it like you really mean it." Then, in a voice that seemed to channel all of her 6 years into somebody I would not want to meet in a dark alley, she said really boldly, "I got this." So as she skied out of the chair perfectly, she stopped and turned to look at me from about 10 feet away. At the same instant, we both smiled and did a one-inch air fist bump. Then she skied off with her instructor. So this is just an application of the mantra, cue, focus, physiology. And the focus can be for people who are visual, like Laurie Hernandez, and thankfully my little buddy. It can be a word, it can be a picture, whatever will work for that person. I'm responding to some of the questions about illustration. Another case example. This is a shorter one, you'll say. Thank you for that. A guy I'm going to call Nathan was a well-known nonfiction writer. He had a book on the New York Times bestseller list. But he found himself, as we began working, experiencing writer's block. By the time he called me, he hadn't written a word for almost nine weeks. I asked him to walk me through his writing process, step by step. I also asked to hear his internal dialogue, what he was saying to himself, frame by frame. He said that when he sat down to write, "I get anxious and I begin doing a lot of different things other than writing. Then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller, or was it just a one-off, a one-time happening?" After exploring the details of this process and his distractions, I observed, partly intuitively, partly from what he said, it sounds like you get really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion you've always wanted to experience. And he said, that's really true. We then looked at how he could reframe that excitement in a way that fostered the process and allowed him to engage rather than seeing it as danger to be avoided. He then created a structure for what he did, and he wrote an even bigger bestseller with that. So that's just a simple illustration of reframing. And that's something we do regularly with our clients. So an everyday application is to recognize and understand the emotional couplings we have. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain. Then the hippocampus, still in the midbrain, attaches meaning. This is what we call the unconscious, where meaning is attached in the hippocampus. Everything at the midbrain is an unconscious process. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to make a logical sense. Now, notice the emotional activation occurs before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. Neuroscientists demonstrate that we make decisions, especially buy purchase decisions, up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware. This comes from a couple of neuroeconomics labs, one of which I correspond with, and also, a kind of an interesting sidebar for this is that neuroeconomists can hook up someone with fMRIs, or hook up a group of people with fMRIs, and predict what they're going to buy. They can show them 10 items for purchase and request that the person purchase one of those. They can predict with over 90% efficiency what someone will purchase. So how do they do that? When they look at each item that activates the part of their brain that has to do more with identity, the sense of self, is exactly what they will purchase. We tend to gravitate to what we're familiar with, what we identify with, and this is why I think it's important with a client. This is a total diversion here. I hadn't planned to say this. One of the couple of things that I request, besides the client information packet, the welcome packet for a new client, many of them, is to do a needs and ideals exercise to know specifically what, for both of us, to know what their needs and their ideals are, from a list of a bunch to name the three major needs, three major ideals, because it's helpful to know those needs and ideals and align the conscious decision processes and the strategies along the lines of needs and ideals. And when they all are part of that flow, it becomes dynamite and very very effective in doing that as they proceed. So this is, I think, useful information as we do that. So let me give another perspective about mantras and self-regulation. This is where this is what informed me with my little skiing buddy and to some extent with Barbara. Here's an illustration. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Roger Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage, lowest in their division nationwide. So during practice, he had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. And remember with Barbara, the mantra was cue, focus, physiology. What Reed did was to recommend that each player have a cue, such as dribbling the ball, and then a focus phrase. And he suggested something like relaxed and smooth, but emphasized that they come up with their own focus phrase. And then at the same time, the physiology of one deep breath in and breathing out any tension. So in the 3 or 4 seconds while they're dribbling, they're doing this. And additionally, he would suddenly, during scrimmage, ask them to go to the three-shot line. If they made both, they got a break. If they didn't, the whole team did 4 laps. In 2 years, the team was ranked number one in their division nationwide. So this is what I'm emphasizing about really the Texas three-step and the cue, the focus, the physiology, just finding a way to get grounded and centered, to have full access to all the information in all of your states of mind, and for the client as well. So here are a couple of things to think about, and I want to make some decision neuroscience principles really simple for us for coaching. There are two forces behind all behavior. I told you I was going to get simple. One is the need to avoid pain. The other is the desire to seek pleasure. Whatever we do, it's motivated by one or both of those. So to understand these motivating forces of pain and pleasure, it's biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis, but trying to create success by creating more pain doesn't really work that well. So to gain or prevent pain moves us in every personal decision, business and personal. An example of gain, promotion, make more money, improve our lives, get what we desire, help our clients. Examples of preventing pain, to avoid any change, to buy insurance, to save money, to stay away from something that we're afraid of. So this is something that, as we appreciate in our clients, that the desire to seek pleasure or to avoid pain is important really to understand, and perhaps in some way to help our clients understand. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do, you link more pain with doing it than not doing it. If you don't have enough money or money that you want, somewhere in your unconscious mind you link greater pain to having it. With a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously you may think that money equals pain. For example, well, all this effort it would take, I'm just as comfortable where I am. People will judge me. I'll be ostracized. I'll be lonely at the top, all alone. So if there's any aspect, let's put it in terms of client. If there's any aspect of a client not taking a step forward or avoiding something that they have decided even would be in their best interest, they're doing one or both of these to seek pleasure or to avoid pain. The pleasure may be obvious. Avoiding pain may be the uncertainty, the trepidation of doing something new that makes someone stop. Because anytime we do something new or different, it triggers discomfort and activates the error detection mechanism. You take a step into the new, the different, the unknown. The brain's error detection mechanism will say, this is not what I expected, or this is not the right thing. So stopping makes sense. So this is a way to use those two forces in a coaching context. When a client has set a goal and avoids it, and they're avoiding some pain of discomfort, and that trumps the pleasure of doing it. What will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost and the pain if you don't do it? And to look at the pleasure part, what will be the greater pleasure if you do that? So looking at one or both of those may be helpful to consciously consider and make this process more conscious and logical, because it's part of that unconscious operating system that determines more than 90% of our behaviors and thoughts and feelings. So this is a way to make it more conscious. If someone, for example, a client has committed to do something, they have a specific plan and a commitment, they get to the point of initiating that and decide not to, or blow it off, or bargain with them. So that's where, if a client has made a commitment at the end of the previous session and begins with saying that's not what they did, or when you ask for an update, they said, well, I really didn't do it. So that's the focus for this session. They've already shown you what it's like to be them, and instead of starting all over again and making more plans, the issue has already been determined. They did not do what they committed to do, so that becomes what you need to focus on, in my view. So one way of doing that is to look at when they had a plan. Let's say they had a plan to do this beginning 11 o'clock Friday. What was the conversation you had in your mind, the instant, the frame, right before you were to take that step to do it? In other words, did you bargain with yourself and say, well, I'm not going to do it now, I'll do it Tuesday? Or, you know, saying, well, you know, I'm just, you know, defy their own authority and say, well, I just want to enjoy myself. Or any other, it's important to know, I think, the internal conversation, because that's what we're addressing with a client, is not just their conversation with us, which will show all of the algorithms, as we've talked before, of thinking and feeling and behaving, but they are becoming more self-aware, more self-reflective of their own process, so that they can address that the rest of the time when we're not talking, and have developed a way, a tool of doing that. So these are the aspects of creating a story with the client and helping them understand their own story and how they're engaging that it's not there until they create it. In other words, whatever they think and feel and experience, what they're creating each moment. Or to say that in a slightly different way, whatever you experience, you're either creating or you're agreeing to. So that puts the client as the author of their own story, and recognizing ultimately that it's not there until they create it. Now, remember, even though you've seen in a number of ways, I use the metaphor of story, and we're co-creating a story and the coaching story for that. The client does not experience any aspect of their life as a story. It's just the way things are. This is our metaphor for organizing and processing things. So this is a way that I think may be helpful to look at and think about how to engage with someone and what makes it beneficial for the client. So here's another thought that kind of dovetails on what we talked about, management of state-specific issues, and I mentioned about like writer's block, any kind of choke or slump or block. This is a state change, and the issue is the management of states of mind. This is an indication of what we may need to help a client do to become more aware of their state of mind. I mentioned about Nathan, the nonfiction writer, to address the regulation of his state of mind and how he could engage in a positive way, framing his excitement as such instead of anxiety or diverting himself into a number of different distractions as an old way of dealing with anxiety, which he recognized immediately. So I want to do just a very brief summary from a different point of view here. How many of you have said this? Well, I practice daily, but I'm not improving. I get distracted, lose my focus. Something always seems to get in the way. What is the most effective way to practice in order to improve performance? We're talking about any kind of performance, intellectual, physical. Do you have a place and a mindset for a particular segment of time? Do you have a reasonable pace? Do you have a goal for each practice? Is there a specific aspect that you try to improve each time? And do you have a mentor or coach or a way of more objectively assessing? Those five questions are the ones one of my favorite authors, Angela Duckworth, went to Anders Ericsson, the father of performance science in this country, and told Ericsson, you know, I've been running for over three decades and I'm not improving. I want to improve, but I'm just not improving. And those are the five questions he asked her. Do you have a place in the mindset? And she answered no to every one. And he said, well, I think we've just seen why you're not improving, because every time you practice, you need to have a focus, a goal, an aspect that you work on, someone who can look at that with you and guide. You're doing it now with me, he said. But that's something that can be improved when you focus on deliberate practice. And he coined that term. And that becomes part of what we can benefit in terms of mentor coaching. So this applies to client challenges. I practice daily, but I'm not improving. I get distracted and lose my focus. Something always seems to get in the way. So these are important aspects that we can focus on and address in terms of the appreciation of mindset and the regulation of state of mind, because this is so fundamental for what we do. And it becomes part of the process that we can help someone do this, and they can see the benefit of engaging in a way that immediately regulates the state of mind. I'll mention this because it's not something I regularly do with a client, but There have been only, in many years of doing mentor coaching now, there have been a couple of instances where someone called at their regular time and said, each of them had a very different kind of disruptive experience, and they were not able, they said, to really make use of the time and just wanted to call out of respect to reschedule. And I said, I hear you, I understand. Could we spend just a minute or two to do something to help you regulate your state of mind? And the first person said yes, and we did a mindfulness meditation. It took a little over a minute. The second person, we did a progressive relaxation, which took just over a minute. Each of them found that that was the most useful thing to get grounded and centered, and they wanted to have a regular session then and to continue. And my belief is the most important thing that happened in that entire session was that first minute or so to find a way to get grounded and centered and to regulate that they could then incorporate to self-regulate in their own way in the future. I'm going to go off of lecture mode. I'll ask you to manage the background. I'm interested to hear any questions. Any questions or comments or things you'd like to add or ask?
Natalie here?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hi.
Hey.
I want to say that it's been a very enlightening session. Thank you so much for that. I absolutely love your five questions at the end. You can apply them to anything, any coaching. It's so true. It brings everyone back to the present moment, to what they can do. And for me, my biggest takeaway from this session is when you said you're either creating or you're agreeing. And that is so true. You're either the pilot or you are in the back seat. And I found that oftentimes that's what happens with coaching that doesn't get anywhere, is when people, they're sitting in the back seat and they tell you about why they're totally out of control. It's all the fault of everything else. But it's so good to bring people back into the front seat and to the creator mode of their story. So thank you so much. Absolutely love those questions, and I will write them all down. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Natalie. And this will work equally well in Canada. So thank you. Any other thoughts or questions or comments? Well, I hope you feel free to respond by email if there are questions or comments or things that you'd like to discuss further or additions that you have. I welcome that, and I appreciate the comments, the kind words. Thank you. So anything you want to add or ask, fire off an email. And notice the resources after the outline of what we're talking about, the outline, so you don't have to take a bunch of notes, but notice the resources and see if that will be helpful. And also, if you have a chance to do the Master States of Mind webinar, bottom link of my homepage, MentorPath, and look at the neural conditioning chart, the thing that I initially, way back, developed with Barbara, the four columns. That's the neural conditioning chart, because when you go horizontally, beginning with an emotional trigger and going all the way to grounding and centering and an ideal behavior, when you repeat that enough, it will rewire your brain so that trigger, instead of creating a dropping into that time capsule of upset, will automatically go to the new behavior. So practiced enough, that can be a way of doing rewiring of your brain. So thank you all very much. And again, feel free to fire off an email if there are any questions or comments. We'll pick up right here next time. See you guys. Bye now.
Thank you. Goodbye.